there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Shouldn't you be at home?
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
I'll have a low-fat pizza or something like that, or a few biscuits and some milk on a Sunday.
And you can pair up if you like, and you can fucking pick someone else to help you, and you can bring your fucking dinner.
Panister and Bruce in the queue again. Bruce scores!
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
No. Hello and welcome back to Now That's What I Call Quickly, Kevin. I'm Chris Gold. Joining me, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello. How are we both?
Very, very well.
What have you been doing with the lockdown, Michael?
I have been doing two things. One's football related, one's not. The first one that isn't is I've been making ice cubes made of pesto.
How are they?
Bought far too much pesto. Well, I haven't defrosted them yet, so, you know, I'll wait and see in about 6 months.
So is it pure pesto, or are you putting some water in to help it freeze?
No, it's pure pesto. It's quite exciting.
And is it frozen?
I haven't checked. I put them in the ice cube tray, wrapped it in foil so it wasn't exposed, and I just tucked it away. So look forward to finding that in about 2 years.
What are you going to do? What are you putting these in a drink?
Well, people keep asking me that, and I hadn't got that far, so I don't really know. I'm obviously not going to make a sort of pesto martini. And then the other thing I've been doing is I bought a Lego Old Trafford.
A lot of people are getting into Lego.
Yeah, it's a sort of fake Lego Old Trafford. But the pieces are about, I'd say, a third to half the size. So it's really fiddly. Like, really fiddly. It's quite stressful, in fact.
I wonder if there's a home park. There's not going to be a home park, is there? Would you do an Olympic Stadium one, Scott?
I don't know if I've got it in me to do a 3D puzzle. I've recently just done a 1,000-piece jigsaw for the first time in my life.
It's good, isn't it, doing a jigsaw?
It is good, but there's so many different phases of frustration towards it. Like, you've got that initial phase where you're just looking for corners and edge bits, and then the next bit where you're just picking up individual pieces, trying to place them, and then towards the end where you just want to get it done. I wouldn't say it's necessarily an enjoyable experience.
What do you do with it at the end?
Just you look here for a second, fold it all up, put it back in the box.
What a waste of time.
It's a waste of time, isn't it?
Everything's a waste of time, Michael. Everything is a waste of time.
Everything is arbitrary. Nothing is that important.
Right. Talking of that, do you want an email about Richard Keys?
Can we get the jingle, please?
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
This is from Nick Raphael. Hi, lads. I listened to your Clive Tilsley episode today and heard the Richard Keys story before the interview. I never thought I'd repeat this story, especially 30 years later, but every year at my secondary school in St Albans, the first 11 would have a game against a John Motson scratch team of ex-athletes, footballers and TV personality. I played in this game once before, and it was mildly competitive and normally a walkover, men against boys, John's team being the men. This year, we had the best team in years. Many of us were playing high-level, competitive, representative football. John was always a total gentleman. Competitive, plus coached and commentated the whole game from fullback, which was hysterical. But this one particular year was marked by the arrival of the one and only Richard Keys of TVAM. Our art teacher, Mr. David Willacy, a professional referee, took charge of the game. And with a substitute either side acting as a linesman, little did any of us know what was about to happen. The game started. Our centre forward passed the ball to me in the centre of midfield. I did my Ray Wilkins-style sideways pass, only to find myself flat on my back, having travelled several feet of the air, according to their linesmen and my teammates, counter two-footed late challenge by Richard Keys. He then proceeded in standing over me and telling me to get up and stop acting. Mr. Willacy missed the challenge, stopped the game, asked what had happened, and all parties said he had taken me out. He argued with everyone. Several of his teammates begged him to calm down. Now with both of us incensed, the game continued. Every time I got the ball, he came looking for me. He was like Norman Hunter on Heat. As the first half was coming to a close, I nutmegged him in the middle of the park and announced Megs. He grabbed the back of my shirt and wrestled me to the ground. By now, the game had descended into chaos. At halftime, Mr. Willacy had to ask John Watson to substitute Richard Keys. Which he did, but Richard remonstrated and threatened to wait for me afterwards.
Oh my God.
The second half took place without incident, except for Richard continuing to try and goad me from the sidelines and parents having to tell him to go home. I believe the John Watson 11 game never happened after that again, and it's a shame it was a highlight of my school calendar. Regards, Nick.
Wow.
I like Richard Keys. He's a competitor.
He's an intense personality.
What I like about Richard Keys, if ever I see an interview, you know, I think there was one on The Athletic a couple of months ago, when you see that Richard Keys has done another interview about how happy he is in Qatar, it's absolutely the best read you can possibly have. All of the quotes about, well, we get more viewers now than we did then. Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it.
I've gone so full circle on him. Is that because all of his opinions and the stuff he used to put out really, used to really annoy me. But now I love that he's out there doing it. Every opinion he's got, I'm like, of course Richard Keys thinks that. I love him as a character.
I love him. I love him. I love him.
Just one more thing on Richard Keys. Do you think him and Andy Gray actually get on? They're kind of like two baddies. I'm thinking, what's a 90s two baddies? Krang and Shredder. Individually.
Bebop and Rocksteady.
Bebop and Rocksteady. Would we have Richard Keys on here to talk about some of those incidents in those charity games?
I think before we approached him, we'd probably delete all of the previous episodes where we told stories about him. Like, do you want some 90s teams?
Yes.
Okay, this is one called 90s 11 of Uncapped Englishmen. Whilst trying to create an ultimate 90s 11, it struck me that a lot of English players from the 90s were established in the Premier League, but never anywhere near the national team. In contrast, with over the last 20 years, the influx of foreign players, it seems that any English player who can hold down a place at a top five club is likely to find at least a couple of caps coming their way. With that in mind, I thought I'd create an 11 of those reasonably successful players who never got the chance to fail miserably for England. Some of them have won major honours. This is from Patrick Jenkinson. Obviously, I'm fully on board with this as a concept. Do you want me to run you through it, or do you want to have a couple? Any guesses?
Steve Bruce?
He said, I didn't consider Steve Bruce, who feels too obvious. Sorry.
I'm going to say Little Alan Wright.
No, was he left back, Little Alan Wright?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say he's possibly better than the... He's got a good left back, though. Do you want me to run you through the team?
Yeah.
Goalkeeper, Tony Cotton. Right back. David May.
No, he's not a right back. He squeezed him in there.
He squeezed him in. All right. Centre back, Paul Warhurst. I think good pick. Centre back, Ian Pearce. Left back, John Beresford. Right midfield, Vinny Samways. Vinny Samways would have definitely represented England these days. Mark Atkins and John Eberl in centre midfield. Left midfield, our Lord Gavin Peacock. And up front, Chris Armstrong and Lee Chapman, who would have definitely played for England these days. I've got an interesting thing on that. I've read a thing about Tony Cotton. Are you aware of this thing about Tony Cotton not getting an England cap?
No.
We discussed this before. Now, this is one of those things where it's a do I remember this right, but Graham Taylor or someone was going to pick him, but didn't pick him because there was a chairman who would have had to pay out a bonus and ask Graham Taylor not to give Tony Cotton a cap.
Really?
Because it would have led. Yeah, I'm sure I read about that.
I don't think we've covered that. I don't remember that.
Yeah. So, Tony Cotton played for Watford under Graham Taylor, and then Graham Taylor tried to sign him for Aston Villa. So when Graham Taylor became England manager, he thought, my ship's come in here. I think he was the most expensive goalkeeper at the time, anyway. But according to Harrison, England coaching staff member Steve Harrison, Manchester City's chairman and FA bigwig put the squeeze on Graham not to pick Houghton, as they would have to pay Watford an extra £350,000 bonus if he made a senior England appearance. So the Man City chairman didn't want to pay the international fee bonus, international cap bonus, so asked Graham Taylor not to pick Tony Coughton for the England team.
God, you'd be remarkable. Livid. If you were Tony Coughton, you'd be absolutely livid.
That's mad, isn't it? That would be heartbreaking if you're Tony Coughton, but there we go. You know, worse things have happened.
I'm fascinated by players who have things in their contract that ultimately become prohibitive to their career. So do you remember like Seth Johnson, when he went to Leeds? He was on such a high league appearance bonus that he was sitting at Leeds, but they couldn't afford to play him.
Oh, what? Because he was on an appearance bonus?
Because he was on an appearance fee. So they basically just couldn't afford to play him, even though he was kind of on a wage.
My favourite one is when players have a clause in their contract that means if they play a certain amount of games in a season, it automatically renews for another year. So you'll get these players, especially players that are sort of older and the club wants rid of them, who they're desperate. They've got no centre forwards available, but this sort of 37-year-old centre forward is one game away from getting an automatic renewal, and the club are like, no, we can't pick him, like we can't play him.
If you have any reasons to get in touch with us, this is how you get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Great. Okay, then. So before we get into our best bits, we have a bit of an announcement. We've got a couple of new formats we're going to try out. Starting with next Tuesday, we're going to introduce the Quickly Kevin Film Club. We're going to be watching a series of 90s football-based films. And the first one up is probably the gold standard for 90s football films. It's When Saturday Comes, featuring that Sheffield United top man, Sean Bean. When Saturday Comes, next Tuesday. And then on Thursday, we're going to follow that up with our first ever quiz that is designed to be played along at home. That means no one buzzing in, giving the answers away. You'll be able to hit play, get a notepad and pen, and try and get the best score you can. So that's coming next Thursday too.
Watch When Saturday Comes before Tuesday, and then you can watch along with us, kind of, you know. You'll know what we're talking about. And get your friends, well, don't get your friends round. That is an awful piece of advice for the quiz. Whatever you do, don't get your friends around. Don't meet up in a park to play the quiz. I cannot emphasise that enough.
But now, enough of all that, it's time for some more best bits.
First up, Pat Nevin tells us about the time he met Saddam Hussein and all of his dealings with Ken Bates.
We'd like to start every episode with the same quiz question.
Go on.
We'd like you to run us through your shirt sponsors throughout your career. And did you get anything free from them? Now, I googled you at Clyde, and I don't think you had a sponsor.
No, first year at Chelsea, no sponsor.
Oh, really?
No. First one with Chelsea was Gulf Air.
Oh, yeah.
I vaguely remember that one.
Get a free flight?
Nope. However, we did go to Baghdad.
Oh, did you? To promote it?
Well, yeah, it was something got to do with that. So we ended up going over to Baghdad. Day of the game, turn up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Everyone's there. Team, their team, the Iraqi national team.
Yeah.
40,000 people, referee, everyone, 100 degrees heat. Nothing happens. We all just stand there. And we stand there. And we stand there. 3:30, we're still standing there. You can't warm up because it's boiling. Anyway, at 4 o'clock, we were allowed to carry on. And the reason being, we had to wait for the guest of honour to turn up. A chap called Saddam Hussein.
Oh, wow! Wow!
So we ended up meeting Saddam afterwards.
You met Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, did you confirm to Ken Bates?
You've took the words in my mouth. I think they were long lost brothers. I think in many ways they have so much in common. We do the game, we finish it, we draw 1-1. We got them to get our trophy, which is the size of this wine glass.
Yeah,
they got them get theirs, which is bigger than me, right? And in the next day's papers, they won 2-1.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow!
Amazing. They did.
That's amazing.
It's great. Ken's. Ken and I had the strangest relationships.
I think he's got strange relationships with everyone.
But we, it's an odd one because it's not we don't dislike each other.
Do you like each other?
No. did I say that too quickly? Well, the reason being, and I think it all came one day, it was 2 days, I did ask to get taken off in a game at halftime to go and see a gig, right?
Yeah.
And he was quite confused about this. And
It was the Colto twins.
Yeah.
And you asked when negotiating a new contract
yes.
to come off at half-time to see them at Royal Albert Hall?
Yeah. The contract negotiations, those were the weirdest ones that I had with Ken.
Right.
When I went into his office. Now, I've never had an agent.
Yeah.
So I went into his office and he said, right. No, he asked me in. He said, right, you need you in a new contract. And I'd signed a 2-year. I'd done a year. I got player of the year, a bit weirdly, because they weren't even expecting me to get in the first team. So he said, you need to sign a new contract. And I went, I don't think I need to, but, you know, if you offer me one, he goes, well, you need a new contract. I said, good, what are you offering me? He says, no, that's not how it works. You need to tell us your demands. And I went, I'm not the demanding type of chap. You know, you've brought me in to offer. And anyway, this toed and froed for a while. I said, look, I'll go away and I'll come back.
Are you
back.
Nervous in this situation?
No, I couldn't give a stuff. I'm not bored. I can play football for the love of it somewhere else.
Yeah.
It didn't matter if I'm paid or not. I wasn't even paid much anyway.
Yeah.
So Ken Bates, he said I had to go away and think about what to have. So I went away, got an A4 sheet of paper and typed out what I wanted. And
can you tell us what you'd written on there?
Okay, so I was on £180 a week beforehand. After tax, you're about 100, 110. My rent was £100 a week. Yeah. There was no money for food unless we won. Fortunately, we won every week that year because we won the league and got promotion. So I could have done with some more money, but you know, I'm a camp student. As long as I can get to gigs, I'm fine. And anyway, so I goes in the next day and I've got the back paper. So I've now asked for £500 a week, 4 or 5 flights a year back to Scotland.
Yeah,
that's about it, really.
Yeah.
So I've came in, put it on the table. Ken's picked it up, looked at it, scrunched it up, threw it in the bin. Stood up, walked out, slammed the door, jumped into his Rolls Royce Corniche and drove away. And I'm sitting there going, that didn't really go great, did it? And I was sitting there and he didn't even say hello. So he's gone before we got to hello.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there. So he made one basic schoolboy error.
Yeah.
He forgot I came from the East End of Glasgow. So I did what everyone from the East End of Glasgow would do. I rifled through his drawers. And I found every single contract of every single player. And that night, I'd done a mean, median, and mode average of them all. So I come in the next day and he goes, have you thought any more about that? And I went, yeah. It's not 500. I want £517.50. And he went, you're having a laugh. What are you? Nobody's on that. And I went, you're right, nobody's on that, but it's the average. And he went, you can't know what the average is. And I said, yeah, I can. I rifle through your drawers. I know what everyone's on. And he just looked at me as if he said,
that is amazing.
Brilliant. It's yours. Give me.
Oh, wow.
So that's the Ken. That's the other side of Ken. And we always had this kind of respect because of it after that.
It's like Heat, you know, De Niro and Pacino in Heat.
Next up, Ellis James talks us through Swansea City and the Vetch in the run-up to the 90s.
What's the state of Swansea City in the 90s?
It's quite an interesting decade. If I can give you a potted history of the club, we were, for about 40 years, quite a solid Division 2 team, as in old, second-tier Division 2, which I think when you look at the size of the city and the catchment area of the club and the fact that rugby union is big as well, that probably suits us, I think. And then we had to apply for re-election to the Football League in 75, and then John Toshack became our player manager and we went 4-3-2-1 in 4 years. Then we came sixth in the first division, having been leaders at Easter. So it looked like we were going to win it. So we were top from the very first game. We beat Leeds 5-1 in the opening day of the season. So we're top until Easter, then we lost 5 out of the last 6 and came 6th, which was the lowest we'd been all season. And the thing is, the early 80s, Ipswich had won the UEFA Cup, Forest had won the European Cup. It was kind of something that could happen in those days.
So what you're saying is you'd probably have won the European Cup as well.
Well, we went 4-3-2-1, 1-2-3-4. So we were in all four divisions twice in 8 years. So
when you were top at Easter, you then went into free fall and were relegated the following season.
Oh. Yeah.
Wow.
So 75 applied for re-election to the Football League, which is quite a close run thing because we're so far west. I imagine Plymouth had this problem. Clubs didn't actually want to play us. And also in the early 70s, we had quite a good side. So you might get 20,000 or 20, or 23,000 at the Vetch, and then 2 years later there's 1,500 there. So the thing with going 4-3-2-1 in 4 years and then having a really good season, the kind of foundations were built on sand, really. So it's all sellouts for a season, and then the club are dreadful, and then it's down to 3,000 again, and then the club got wound up on Boxing Day, I think, or Christmas Eve 1985, and then in the 90s we were just a low division team, so we were just dreadful. It was a car crash.
What was the Vetch like?
The Vetch was,
because I've walked past it and it looked awful.
I loved it. But
how bad were the facilities?
Routinely voted the worst toilets in the Football League.
So how bad were they?
It was a trough. I once met a bloke who'd had a shit at the Vetch, and I shook him by the hand.
This is a favourite subject of mine. I never had a poo at Upton Park until the last game ever there. Yeah. I'm like,
no, it's a blessed relief for the Olympic Stadium. Yeah, yeah. The toilets are nice and the ground.
Do you know what? The thing with the...
There's still a toilet at Argyle. So Argyle have got three sides of identical new ground, as you imagine it, and then one, the old grandstand. The toilets, which are just a wall, literally, you know, you walk in, there's a wall, and then there's, what would it be? Just a drain, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it just, it's been there 100 years being pissed on.
Yeah, yeah.
100 years.
Imagine that, being pissed on for 100 years.
Do you know how I would sum up the Vetch? All our most vocal fans used to stand on the north bank, which ran along the side of the pitch. And it was a very, very big stand, very big terrace at one point. But then it was condemned, the final two-thirds were condemned by the council. So they just built... They just built a plywood wall about a third of the way up because there were holes in the floor, and the plywood wall was sponsored by Monster Munch.
Which flavour?
It was the purple. That's
pickled onion.
Pickled onion, isn't it? So I never got to stand on the North Bank in all its glory, because that happened in the late 80s.
So what
were
the pit? Was it like proper Monster Munch kind of mural?
It was a very...
Like that Arsenal mural, but with monsters.
Yeah, so it was a very big terrace that held about 20,000 at one point. So then they built this wall a third of the way up, this plywood wall that was sponsored by Monster Munch. And people used to chuck their burgers over the wall.
Yeah.
And then in the final game we played at the Vetch against Shrewsbury, some people started pulling the wall down. I went and had a look and stood at the back. And it was quite interesting because there were these huge gaping holes, and it would have cost the club £250,000 to mend. So obviously it wasn't financially viable. But there were these big holes. You think, how did they let it get into this state in the first place? But the thing I really liked was there was a lot of graffiti from the early 80s. It was a kind of a time capsule, because they built the Monster Munch wall and had just left it. So there was all like Alan
There was
Curtis.
One guy still in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on, Sydney!
Living on the pies.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And then you had the away end, which I don't remember this, but it had been a double-decker that was made of wood. So it was a twin-tier stand. And then the top of it was condemned by the council. So what they did was they just removed the top. So it was...
Replaced it with a Monster Munch roof.
No, but what happened? If you stood on the away end, you'd look up and there'd be stairwells leading to nowhere. And just these footwells go into a stand that no longer existed.
It doesn't exist.
And finally, Graham Massot tells us about the Blackburn training ground and his time at the title-winning club.
You said a minute ago, like, you know, Blackburn was so much more professional, but there's a quirk about your training ground that I really hope is true in Pleasanton. So there was a local cemetery and crematorium nearby, and a road between the training pitches that led to them, and at regular intervals, a funeral party would drive down the road and you'd have to stop training to pay your respects.
It was not so much that we stopped training. We sort of, you know, you'd hesitate a little bit because obviously it's slightly awkward, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But more noticeable than that was the fact that on the way back down, they'd all be out the windows wishing us best of luck for the next, you know. I think a few of the funeral corteges had scarves underneath their suits and everything, and they were waving out and maybe stopping for a few autographs and, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it was a public park, so people walked their dogs on there.
Really?
They'd be, you'd have to clear up the crap.
Wow. And you're the Premier League champions or Super
League
champions?
Well, we were sort of, that was the first two seasons. I think the year we won the league was the year we moved to Brockle, the training ground that they've got now, which was phenomenal. I remember there was some guy with a, it was either a falcon or an owl of some sort, training his owl whilst we're trying to train, and he's letting his owl off. Alan Wright could have been taken away. That could have been plucked from left back, never seen again, so up a tree somewhere.
Kenny's like keeping the ball on the floor. You can't hit the owl.
Absolutely. Yeah, Kenny Dabley started giving the falcon tips, criticising its flight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Wow. So it was really random. And what we used to do, we used to have to go to the stadium, to Ewood Park, get changed there, car share.
Wow, so you're driving
to Pleasanton.
So who's in your
not
car?
Not Sir Pleasanton, as I like to call it. Well, it was whoever, you just used to rotate it, you know.
Yeah.
The problem was none of us wanted to drive because invariably you get either just full of dirt or you could end up slide and tackling some dog poo.
Yeah.
And you don't want people in your leather seats and your Volkswagen Golf on the way back, you know. So I was always a reluctant designated driver.
Yeah.
But that's what we used to do, and we did it for ages. And the kits, if you ever came round to my cottage, you would see a clothes horse with at least three kits on it just drying out at any stage, you know.
That's insane. And you're in the Premier League.
Yeah, but the great thing was we were
all
together.
Did you ever shrink your kit?
No, I didn't, because it was so robust and heavy. It was it was like a rugby shirt.
Oh yeah, I remember
it was
that.
A rugby shirt with a collar and buttons.
Yeah.
And then we had big long shorts that were, I mean, it took hours and hours to dry it. I mean, I went through three tumble dryers in my time at Blackburn. It was so heavy. But to be fair, everybody did it. It wasn't like Kenny was getting his done at the by somebody at the local laundry or...
Was Alan Shearer genuinely getting it? Because I suspect he was getting Mike Newell to do it.
Like, maybe, Mike Newell did everything else for him, didn't he? All his running. So, Mike, you can do the kit as well. He would have done, I think.
So summer of 94, it begins. You're about to win the league. One of the big reasons why, obviously, Chris Sutton signing. You mentioned him a minute ago. But did him and Shearer get on? Were they mates?
There was a little bit of friction.
Yeah.
Because Mike Newell and Alan were really close. Mm. There was a group of them, the Southport Massive.
One of the worst garage groups I've ever heard.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So who's in the Southport Massive?
So you had Tim Flowers.
Yeah.
Alan Shearer.
Yeah.
Mike Newell.
Yeah.
Kenny lived over there as well.
Yeah.
So that was where...
All the Liverpool players lived.
Yeah,
there,
that's where the wealthy...
Handsome people.
That, yeah, but that was where the wealthy Blackburn players lived.
Right.
Because they could afford the petrol to drive in. But they were the... Yeah, you always felt that they knew a bit more about who the team was going to be on a Saturday than the rest of us, because they'd be round, you know, live near the manager.
So you won the league, like, in dramatic fashion, obviously. Mm. You lose to Liverpool, but West Ham, my team, a draw with Man United, and deliver you the league. What do you remember?
Give
that,
you
then?
The league. After 40 games, West Ham gave us the league.
It's a class, isn't
it? No, you own it. I should have just handed my medal straight to you.
Straight to Tony Gale.
Well, Tony Gale was at Blackburn.
He was.
Because that kind of the drama of that last day when you're listening to a score from another game, I mean, what do you remember?
It was the most awful experience. To win the league in that situation was just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Because...
Did your game finish first? Or
no,
something?
Theirs finished first. Theirs finished just before we conceded... just after we'd conceded the second goal. So we were going back to the halfway line with our heads down, having thought Manchester United must have beaten West Ham, all due respect. You know, so we presume Manchester United had won or were about to win, and we just conceded a second goal, and I don't think we'd been out of our half the whole second half up at Anfield. And it was as we were walking back towards the halfway line to restart the game that our fans went from being utterly morbid and desperate and suicidal to then this ripple of like sort of positive energy.
Yeah.
And they're talking, and then they start jumping up and down. I'm thinking, well, they've clearly lost the plot. And then it worked its way. It was a bit like a Mexican wave, you know, going across. It sort of missed the Liverpool fans out of it.
Yeah.
But then it got to our bench, and you saw them start getting up, and we're like, what's going on? And then we realised what had happened, that they'd obviously, the game had been drawn. Mm. And I can't remember for the life of me who the referee was. But a couple of the players said, look, just blow up. And he's like, no, you've got, you know, 1 minute left or 18 left.
Sounds like David Ellery.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be. Yeah. And we had to kick off and just go through the motions.
Did people
we're just like, oh, come on, let's get the trophy. Where's the trophy? Where's the champagne? Because it was such a relief, because we'd absolutely bottled it in the previous weeks leading up to that. Because we had a 9-point lead and we were playing so well, and then we lost a game, and Ferguson started, you know, he was doing all the mind games on, you know, on the TV and on the radio. And then you start, you get to that point in the season where you start actually thinking and listening out for your closest rivals' results, because we didn't have that experience as a group of players. And Manchester United were phenomenal. I mean, they won it the 2 years before. They won it the year after with, you know, that Man United squad was arguably the best team Manchester United have had. I mean, I suppose you could say 99,
yeah,
where they won the treble. But, I mean, that team was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it was just, it would have been so dispiriting to have lost it on the last game of the season. Yeah. We deserved to win it. We really did.
I always like to ask this question. Where do you keep your medal?
I keep, well, everything I've won, I keep in a Adidas bag in the loft.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Do you make a little display
in your toilet?
No. It's just not something that I feel I need to remind myself of. You know, I don't mean I don't appreciate it. I mean, crikey. You know, I being part of a club that has won the Premier League or won the trophies that I've won or played for England the amount of times I have, I think being part of that is phenomenal. I don't need to look at sort of something to remind me of that. It doesn't make me less proud. It's just I don't think it's about me. And I mean, can you imagine trying to hoover around your England caps? It's been a nightmare.
those tassels
straight up.
Oh, what's going up the Dyson again?
Okay, that's it for today. That's enough Best Bits. We'll be back on Monday with Dave Besson. It is a cracking episode. Really, really good. Well, it's time to end these episodes as we always do. Josh, have you got the Des Lynam CD to hand?
I do.
And can I have number 17?
Des, take it away.
And we'll be back Monday. Until then, Robbie Slater, see you later.
How straight it flew, how long it flew. It cleared the rutty track and, soaring, disappeared from view beyond the bunker's back. A glorious, sailing, bounding drive that made me glad I was alive. And down the fairway, far along, it glowed a lonely white. I played an iron, sure and strong, and clipped it out of sight. And spite of grassy banks between, I knew I'd find it on the green. And so I did. It lay content 2 paces from the pin. A steady putt, and then it went, oh, most securely in. The very turf rejoiced to see that quite unprecedented three. Seaweed smells from sandy caves, and thyme and mist in whiffs. Incoming tide, Atlantic waves, slapping the sunny cliffs. Lark song and sea sounds in the air, and splendor, splendor everywhere.